Welcome to episode 230 of the Solomonster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com for Sunday, July 29th, 2012. I'm the Solomonster. Big thank you to everybody who has helped make episode 228 of the Sound Off the fastest downloaded episode to date. That, of course, was the special episode where I listed my top 30 top Raw moments in history leading up to Raw 1000, the big show this past Monday night from St. Louis, Missouri, which we're going to get into right now. A full report on Raw 1000 from St. Louis, which to me was the tale of two shows. On the one hand, it was really fun to see so many old faces back on TV at the same time. You have the DX reunion with all of the members except for China, of course, which I found to be enjoyable. I enjoyed seeing Brock Lesnar finally back on TV and looking like a total beast. I don't know if it was the haircut or the fact that he was much more tanned than he was when we last saw him on TV, but he looked good. The Rock was, of course, The Rock. Not his best night on the mic or anything, but he brings an intensity to the show that is sorely lacking in his absence, especially at the end of the show, which we'll get to. He was totally amped up when he did that run-in in the main event. They made a huge announcement months in advance for the Royal Rumble next year, and they did so in front of their largest audience in years, which I'll get to in just a moment here. And, of course, there was the big angle at the end of the show. Yes, it was a shitty DQ finish to the Cena Punk match with Big Show running in, but the Punk turn, or apparent turn, as it were, I guess we'll find out if he's a full heel or more of a tweener this week. I thought it was very well done, though. It felt like a lot of star power out there. You had The Rock out there fighting Big Show, and you have Cena flat on his back. Punk runs in and interrupts the people's elbow to lay out The Rock, which was a genius way of getting people to boo him, by the way. Obviously, he still got cheered by some people, but by the end, it was mostly boos. You take away something that people paid to see, it's the quickest way to get heat. Plus, they've been planting the seeds of Punk snapping for weeks now, you know, with Eve berating him a couple weeks ago, and Big Show talking about how he's been playing second fiddle to John Cena and whatnot. What's great about that is it's 100% true. And, you know, I've been talking about it for months. Now, I'd like to give WWE credit by saying that, looking back, now it all makes sense that Punk has been relegated to the undercard because it was all part of some grand storyline, but I don't buy that for a second. I think they just realized that, hey, you know, we've been treating our champion like a second-class citizen all year. Why don't we use it to our advantage and just turn him heel? But you can sympathize with Punk because he has been treated like a second-class citizen for so long. Not a single day has gone by in the 2012 calendar year without having CM Punk as your champion. He has been champion every day this year. And this guy couldn't buy his way into a pay-per-view main event. And it appears that will now change, although I shouldn't speak so fast, I guess, because they are, after all, doing Lesnar versus Triple H at SummerSlam, which could very well get the main event spot, especially if Hunter is going over. We also had the return of The Undertaker to save his brother Kane. Always cool to see the Brothers of Destruction back together, even if it really doesn't make any sense at all, given the last time they interacted with one another. Kane had turned on his brother for the zillionth time and beaten him in three straight pay-per-view matches. In fact, he had put him into a coma, if I remember correctly, a vegetative state, I should say. WWE has a way of staying away from certain controversial words. You know, instead of just calling it a coma, they called it a vegetative state. Just like when Goldust was electrocuted by Evolution all those years ago, they wouldn't say that he had Tourette's. It was a neurological disorder. So I think that's just their way. That was just their way of kind of hedging their bets on that one. But anyway, the last time we saw any real interaction between the two, they were feuding. Now they're not. But we've long passed the point of things making sense with the lineage of Kane and Undertaker and their backstory. So I don't really think it matters at this point. Plus, to me, this just proves that Kane has, in fact, reverted back to being a babyface, which I think sets the all-time record for turns in WWE. Big Show doesn't trail Kane by much, but he's got to be the all-time record holder of going back and forth between heel and face over the years. And then there was Sean Mooney backstage interviewing Daniel Bryan for all of 10 seconds, which just made my night. I mean, it's Sean Mooney, for Christ's sake. Come on now. The guy hasn't aged a day. I was just disappointed that he wasn't wearing his old blue WWF logo jacket that he used to be wearing when he would do those event center updates in the early 90s. So anyway, there was a lot to like about this show. It also did huge numbers, averaging over 6 million fans when the show these days normally does around 4.5 million, give or take. Could be a little, you know, sometimes it'll hit 5. The 3-hour block, which again, this was the first of what will supposedly be the permanent stay for these 3-hour Raw shows, although I still question how long this will last. But the 3-hour block rounded up, did a 3.9 rating, and the traditional 9 to 11 p.m. block did a 4.0, which they haven't done since that commercial-free Raw with Donald Trump back in 2009, and you can't even really compare the two because that was commercial-free and this was not. The overrun did a 4.4, meaning that almost 7 million people saw the CM Punk heel turn, and in terms of demographics, apparently teenage boys were huge on this show. They did a 5.6 for teenage boys. So all that hype resulted in a huge success for WWE, at least for one night. But it was not all good. This show was hyped up so much for so long that, you know, when it was over, for all of its enjoyable moments, I still couldn't help but feel underwhelmed. It just felt like something was missing. You know, I was expecting more stars from the past that we haven't already seen a million times on TV. I mean, all due respect to the Jim Duggins and the Sergeant Slaughters of the world, and Bret Hart, who was barely even a footnote on this show, and Mick Foley, who could have been used better. I felt like they could have changed it up a little bit more. You know, I feel like this was also the perfect opportunity to introduce a new character, like a Dean Ambrose, in some meaningful role before their largest audience in ages. I'm not saying you give away the store on this show, but, you know, you whet people's appetites and leave them wanting to want more the following week. You know, I can understand maybe worrying about a new guy getting lost in the shuffle on a what really is just a nostalgia show, but you can't tell me that using that wedding to introduce Ambrose, for example, would not have been a better payoff than what they ended up giving us. You cannot convince me of that. The only good thing about that wedding was Slick. The Reverend Slick back on this show, and that's saying a lot. But, you know, Daniel Bryan and AJ played their roles fine, but just the way the whole wedding was booked was just completely disappointing. And having John Cena become the first person to unsuccessfully cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase on a DQ run-in was unbelievably lame. I mean, you had to have a screwball finish there, I get that, but, you know, fine. Let Big Show interfere, but still have Punk get the pin at least. You know, ending it on a disqualification like that and not even making a big deal about Cena being the first to cash in and fail was just such a waste of the briefcase. I don't even know that they mentioned it once. Those were really the only things I hated about the show. I'm not even going to complain about the total lack of actual wrestling on a 3-hour show because I wasn't expecting a lot of wrestling this week. You know, that's for next week. I thought it was a fun trip down memory lane, and it was a very newsworthy show because of Rock's announcement and Punk turning heel, but, you know, it wasn't even the best Raw of the year or anything like that. To me, that still belongs to Miami the night after WrestleMania. And I am a bit partial since I was at that show, but even if I wasn't, you go back and read reviews of that Raw after WrestleMania, and it was a fun show. So this was a fine program, not the best Raw of the year or anything like that. I see a lot of people were very upset when it was over. They were trashing it. They couldn't wait to listen to the sound off. Solo Monster is going to eviscerate this show. I will do no such thing. It was not a perfect show, and like I said, when it was over, I felt kind of underwhelmed, even with the Punk turn, which I thought was really cool, but it just felt like there were things missing on this show, one of which was not WWE's fault, was Stone Cold Steve Austin, who I was convinced would be on this show, and in fact, he was not, and it turns out the reason that Stone Cold missed Raw was because he underwent major knee surgery on his left knee back on July 2nd. The surgery was a success, and Austin has begun physical therapy. He is on crutches. He will be fitted for, what else? A custom knee brace. He'll be in that for about 9 to 12 weeks. And he didn't want to show up for Raw on crutches, he said. And I admit, that is not the way Stone Cold ought to be portrayed. hobbling down to the ring on one leg. It's a shame, though, because aside from Randy Savage and Bobby Heenan, who are the two people that stand out to me, particularly from those early days of Monday Night Raw, they really deserve to be on that show, and obviously they could not be. Aside from those guys, Steve Austin was the one who was sorely missing from this show. And, you know, it's tough doing a show like this and not hearing the glass shatter. You know, one of the great things about Punk going heel, though, is that it makes a match, a potential match with Austin at WrestleMania next year, that much more likely. You know, and I don't know if Austin's coming back or not. From what I understand, this is major knee surgery. He may need 6 to 8 months just to recover. It's not like in 2 months he's going to be back to 100% or anything like that. Although I guess it depends on how severe the knee surgery was. And I've heard that he's had other surgeries as well, perhaps that he has not revealed over the last few years, you know, shoulder surgery and maybe another knee surgery. So it's not even a guarantee that he'll ever wrestle again. Maybe he likes teasing the idea because it keeps his name out there, but you know, certainly if they were going to go in that direction, the Punk turn makes it that much more likely. Like I said, Punk has to be the heel in that match. You cannot bring back one of the biggest baby faces in wrestling history for his first match in 10 years, if it were to happen, and put him in there with another babyface. I mean, it would still be a big match, don't get me wrong. If, for example, they wanted to do Austin Rock 4, I don't think too many people would be complaining about that. But you really don't want to muddy the audience reactions that way, where it's kind of a split reaction, people don't know who to cheer for. You don't want that. But to me, I was thinking about it, you know, if Austin was on this show, how cool would it have been to have Austin, the biggest star in Raw history out there, to do color commentary for the main event? And you've got Big Show interfering, he causes the DQ, he is stomping the stuffing out of John Cena, Punk is not doing anything to help, and in fact, he's walking out. You got Austin on commentary, you know, saying, what the hell is Punk doing? Where are you going, son? He throws his headset down, goes into the ring to put a stop to this, and gets a few right hands in on Big Show, but ends up getting knocked out of the ring, and then you just let everything else play out exactly as it did. And in the end, as Punk stands over The Rock's body, you've got Steve Austin getting back up on the outside, looking up. He locks eyes with Punk, with both guys just staring a hole in one another. It's just a nice... It would be a nice, subtle way, I think, of planting the seeds early for something down the road if they wanted to eventually do a Punk-Austin match. And if the match were to never happen, who cares? It doesn't... You know, it's just a nice way, I think, of using Austin if he were on this show in that main event segment where you can tease all these different things. You know, they tease doing Rock and Punk, which is probably going to be the match at the Royal Rumble. You could tease Austin and Punk in that situation. It was just an idea that I had that I thought would have worked, I think, in this situation. And plus, having Austin and Rock both out there in that final segment would have been really cool, even if they didn't interact on TV. But knee surgery is a pretty good excuse for his absence, and here's hoping that the Rattlesnake heals up quickly and can get back to doing what he does. I was surprised not to see the Million Dollar Man or IRS on this show. They were certainly prominent in those early days of Monday Night Raw. At least DiBiase was in 93. IRS stuck around, I think IRS stuck around through 95, part of 95 anyway. And they've made Legends appearances before on this show. So, you know, it's a situation where guys like Dusty Rhodes and Ricky Steamboat, they were never really as prominent on Raw. So I get not including them, but I don't know why the other two were not featured on the show. I haven't heard that, you know, anything is wrong or there's any heat or anything. And in fact, I think IRS still is an agent behind the scenes. So that was one of the things that struck me. I'm not sure why either one of those guys wasn't on the show. As far as one other thing I want to address here, the WWE using the old Scratch logo, the old WWF Scratch logo in various clips on this show, particularly during the clips of Austin versus McMahon. A lot of people commented on that, wrote into me about it, and the only update I have is that apparently certain instances of its use are now okay, at least for certain clips. I have no idea if that's just for TV and the blurs are going to stay on DVD releases and all that. It does make sense that they, you know, would pay whoever they had to pay, the Panda people or whoever, to be able to use the logo without the blurs, given the fact that, you know, they're about to launch a 24-hour network, maybe sometime this century, possibly. And it would be awfully distracting to have blurs all over the place. So if they did pay off somebody for the right to be able to use that logo without having to blur it out and edit it out. I'm not saying when you can't speak the initials WWF. I don't think you're allowed to do that still, but it would be very nice to be able to see that Attitude Era logo without having to look at blurs and feel like I have cataracts in my eyes. So that may be a step in the right direction there, but I haven't read anything else on that. So if I find out, I'll let you guys know. But just to run through some of these segments real quick on this Raw 1000 show. Had the DX stuff, as I said, a lot of fun. Billy Gunn looked good. X-Pac, on the other hand, looked like he was 6 months pregnant. Either that or he's on the Claire Lynch diet. Damian Sandow got a bit of rub by being out there with those guys, even if he was buried in the end. But his character is a snob, and he got put in his place, so that is fine. Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara teamed up for the very first time, which should have been a bigger deal than they made it out to be. I think Jim Ross may have made a comment here about that fact, but it was never really brought up that this was the first time teaming together. They teamed with Sheamus against Alberto Del Rio, Dolph Ziggler, and Chris Jericho, whom they beat. Jim Ross, as I mentioned, was brought out to announce one match on this entire three-hour show, and this was it. And what a load of shit that was. He's rocking the full Stone Cold goatee now as JR. I half expected him to start flipping people off and smash two bottles of barbecue sauce together and start guzzling them. Fortunately, he did not. His voice alone made this match sound somewhat important. Jericho got pinned by a brogue kick after Ziggler nailed his own partner, so it does seem like they're building to a Jericho-Ziggler match at SummerSlam, which should be awesome. Throughout the show, they spoke with Charlie Sheen via Skype. They use Skype on those TNA Today shows they do with Jeremy Borash on TNAWrestling.com, where they interview people, and I dislike this very much. Just send a goddamn camera to the dude's house. I mean, is it really that hard? The quality is just so shitty. Anyway, he did a good job of masking the fact that he was reading off cue cards and pretending to be familiar with the product, so this was fine. And at one point when the show was dragging, I thought it would be hilarious if they went back to Charlie Sheen and showed him with cocaine powder all over his face. But sadly, this did not happen. It would have been great WWE comedy, though, to have him explain that, you know, Mr. Fuji had just thrown salt in his face or something like that. Later on, they teased a possible SummerSlam match between Daniel Bryan and Charlie Sheen. And they didn't exactly confirm anything like that, which makes me think that maybe they don't have a firm deal in place for this match. But they were certainly teasing it as a possibility. Charlie Sheen was like, hey, you know, anytime Daniel Bryan wants to come to L.A., I'm not hard to find. And, of course, SummerSlam is in L.A., so we'll see if Charlie Sheen actually wrestles in WWE. That's one wellness test I would love to see the results of, I'll tell you that much. They did some comedy backstage with AJ and Layla, with AJ talking about how she is not crazy. Just take a look around this place. And she opened the door to the hallway, and they showed Hacksaw Jim Duggan acting all retarded, and Roddy Piper with R-Truth fondling Little Jimmy or whatever the hell they were doing, and Mae Young introducing her adult son, all grown up in a giant hand costume. Keep in mind that he is allegedly the son of Mark Henry. So either science be damned, or Mark Henry has a ready-made storyline for when he returns, where he takes a paternity test in the middle of the ring to prove whether or not he is the father of Mae Young's hand. It was some white, geeky kid with glasses in a hand costume. So I've already spent way too much time talking about this, so we'll move on here. Brodus Clay pinned Jack Swagger literally in 10 seconds with a splash. I'm just waiting for the day that Jack Swagger comes to the ring and just blows his brains out on live TV. I fear that is where this is going. This was the match, by the way, all 10 seconds of it, where they decided to parade Mick Foley out in his rather unflattering Dude Love attire. He did absolutely nothing of note, which seems like a fantastic way to use one of the biggest stars in Raw history on this 1,000th episode. I mean, at least let the guy show up as Mankind and Cactus Jack at other points during the show. You know, the three faces of Foley. Nope. He made this one appearance, and he was gone. Then it was time for the wedding. I always cry at weddings. And actually, no, I don't cry at weddings. I almost cried at this wedding because of how bad it was. They introduced the Reverend Slick to officiate the ceremony, and he came to the ring to the sounds of Jive Soul Bro, which was awesome. One of my favorite all-time entrance themes. He should have brought Akeem, the African Dream, with him. And now that I'm sitting here during thinking about this. I was watching this show, thinking about the old Jive Soul Bro music video. If you've never seen it, I'm positive you can find it on YouTube. They did a music video for it. And I was thinking about that and remembering how unbelievably racist it was. I mean, they had Slick sitting in a restaurant at the beginning of the video. And this may not be part of the actual music video, but I have somewhere around here an old VHS cassette of music videos from the WWF's old Pile Driver album. So Slick introduces the music video. He's sitting in a restaurant somewhere, eating out of a bucket of fried chicken. I mean, you would think they can never get away with that sort of thing today, right? I mean, you would think that. Well, no sooner do I think that than Slick on this show gets on the microphone and talks about looking forward to getting himself some Yardbird after the show. Well, it is quite delicious. I cannot disagree. Other than Slick, the only other fantastic thing about this segment was the fact that AJ came out wearing delightful... She was wearing a delightful wedding dress and tennis shoes. I like this girl. Jerry Lawler was cracking marriage jokes, the best of which I thought was, marriage is grand, but divorce is $100,000. I laughed at that. They did the ceremony. Brian said yes. He takes her to be his bride. AJ said yes, yes, yes. And then came the swerve. She said that she wasn't talking about Brian. She had received a proposal from someone else earlier that day. And at that point, I thought to myself, yes, this is where Ambrose comes in. This is going to be great. And then we hear no chance in hell. And out walks Vince McMahon. And I thought to myself, uh-oh, Linda's campaign won't be too happy about this. And Vince then explains that it wasn't what we were all thinking. It was a business proposal. And he then introduces AJ as the new general manager of Raw. Now, I am not totally against the idea of having AJ as the GM. Vicky Guerrero certainly grew into the role on SmackDown, and AJ is a much better actress than Vicky Guerrero is, and much cuter, too. Plus, you know, it's a way to keep her involved on TV without continuing this same storyline for another 6 months. I mean, really, how much further can you go with her and Brian and her and Punk, and her and Kane, of course, is over? But you're going to tell me that the board of directors, so concerned over John Laurinaitis' abuse of power that they had him excommunicated, is seemingly okay with appointing a disturbed crazy woman as the new general manager of your flagship show? A person who only a few weeks ago was threatening to put herself through a table on TV. And who has smooched, I think, about half the roster already. I mean, shit, if I knew the qualifications were so low, I would have applied for the position myself. And then I would have promptly fired myself. Not before announcing that I had put in place an ironclad provision stating that WWE is never again allowed to appoint a GM for any of their shows. That's what I would do. I mean, after all, they had John Laurinaitis, who was already fired, come out on TV and announce, before I was fired, I announced. I mean, it's complete shit, so why not? That's what I would have done. So anyway, that was the commercial. That was the wedding, I should say. Back from commercial, we had some banter back and forth in the ring between Daniel Bryan and CM Punk about who the best in the world is. That brought out The Rock. He made fun of Bryan. He called him an Oompa Loompa and a Hobbit. He then announced, out of nowhere, by the way, that he would be wrestling the WWE Champion for the title at the Royal Rumble in January. And it was smart of them to do, knowing that they were going to have such a big audience. But yes, very, very dumb for those of us trying to make sense of things as far as how does Rock just walk in and get a title shot? I mean, if I were left with the task now of trying to explain this to people, if my title in WWE was like to explain bullshit after the fact, the only argument I can make here is that The Rock beat John Cena at WrestleMania. And Cena is the top guy in the company. So therefore, The Rock is as deserving of a shot as anyone. But I agree, it's still ridiculous. At the end of the day, it's going to help boost whatever the buy rate would be for the Rumble. It makes the show that much more special. And it gives us a fresh match of Rock versus Punk, which is what I figure the match is going to be. You know, as much as I wouldn't mind seeing a triple threat with Rock, Punk, and Bryan, and I'm no fan of triple threat matches, Rock versus Punk has a certain appeal to it. And the promo work would be fantastic, I think. So I would be in favor of letting Punk hold on to the title until then, which would give him the longest reign probably since the first Hogan run with the belt from 84 to 88. It'll be a much bigger deal when Rock beats him for it than it would be if, let's say, he drops it between now and then, if he trades the title back and forth between himself and John Cena, which they could certainly do. If Punk just wins the title back just like he did last year, it just doesn't mean as much. So Rock gave Bryan a rock bottom to end the segment. I just like seeing Daniel Bryan in there jaw-jacking with The Rock. After all those years that I championed this guy's cause on my show, and I was far from the only Bryan Danielson fan. I mean, he was a guy who people could see big things in the future for. It was just a matter of whether or not he would ever get a shot, because he is a smaller guy and great wrestler, but that isn't always a priority in WWE. And the guy has a certain charisma. The thing is, he's a very quiet guy by nature. So his charisma doesn't necessarily shine through the way it does with The Rock. The Rock has charisma too, but it's a very different charisma than Daniel Bryan's charisma. But the fact that he has gotten over, he's been a world champion, he's in there with The Rock, I mean, I just think it's really cool, to see that the dude has made it. And he's money. I'm happy for him. Bret Hart came out as the ring announcer for the Intercontinental Championship match. His introduction of The Miz was awesome. If you didn't see it, you gotta find the clip on YouTube and just watch it. I say The Miz should be announced that way for every match until the end of time. They had a decent match, Miz and Christian. Nothing overly special. Christian was selling a knee injury, which played into the finish. And I will say that when Miz nailed Christian with the skull-crushing finale, the people did react. I think because they figured, oh shit, we're about to see a title change. And he got the pin, he won the Intercontinental Championship, did Miz for the very first time, and he made a big deal about it. He was kissing the belt, and he made it feel kind of special. And as I said on Twitter, I will give the devil his due. Miz does look good with that white Intercontinental belt. They've got to rehab the guy after beating him down for so long, so this is a nice first step in the process. I have no interest in seeing Miz in the world title picture right now, but Miz with the Intercontinental Championship, I don't have a problem with that. They did the Triple H Brock Lesnar angle on this show, which did not include Lesnar killing Shawn Michaels, or any of the DX members, in fact. When Paul Heyman came out on Brock's behalf and said no, and then Stephanie came out and they were all attacking Heyman, I thought for sure they were going to cut to the back on the Titantron and show all of the members of DX laying on the floor, bloodied up or something, but nope. Stephanie conned Paul Heyman into accepting Triple H's challenge for SummerSlam, and then out came Lesnar. And as I said earlier, he was looking like a beast. The guy still has that explosive agility that just made him so much fun to watch as a big guy back in the day. I mean, watch when Triple H clotheslines him out of the ring. He goes flying over the top rope, and he rolls halfway up the aisle. I love that. He's very underrated as a bump taker. So anyway, their match is official for next month. It's still time to have Lesnar destroy Shawn Michaels if they want to. It's not too late. Certainly would be a good way to get heat on that match. Howard Finkel was trotted out as the ring announcer for the next match. I still feel that JR should have called the entire show with Cole and King, and that Finkel should have done the announcing, just like he did for the first Raw back in 93. But whatever. I mean, it was good to at least see him out there. As I mentioned, he was on that very first show. He should have been there. Heath Slater came out to challenge any legend in the back to a no-count-out, no-disqualification match. So who should accept his challenge but Lita? And she then tells Slater that she invested in a little protection, which may well be the first time she has ever uttered those words before. And out comes the APA, Farouk and Bradshaw. And Heath Slater tries to bail. He gets stopped on the stage by Road Warrior Animal and Vader and Sid and all of the legends that he has wrestled over the last month or so. Doink, Bob Backlund, Rikishi. So they all throw him in the ring, and Lita gives him the Twist of Fate, which just seems wrong that she's still using that move. And then she goes up for a moonsault onto Slater for the 1-2-3. Maybe the most surreal moment to me of all of this is after the match, listening to Lita's grunge music, blaring in the background, and seeing Bob Backlund, of all people, standing there in the ring. Just, I don't know. I just thought that was quite the sight. And JBL, it's worth noting here that JBL also gave Slater a wicked clothesline from hell that Slater sold just expertly on the show. He actually managed somehow to balance himself on his head for a few seconds before finally toppling over. And so he sold that great. This was enjoyable. This was fun. And in fact, This segment apparently on the show did very well. So well, in fact, that WWE now is considering having a legend segment of some sort on every single Raw going forward. So, I mean, they trot out legends, I think, often enough on the show. They don't do it every week or anything like that for different segments or comedy skits or a match here or a match there. But apparently they're considering doing something for every single Raw because this legend segment did so well, which I disagree with. As much as I love seeing the legends, I think it's a bad move. Because, yeah, the segment did very well, but you know exactly what's going to happen. If they give us some sort of legend segment every single week, by week three or four, it's not going to be doing so well. You know, you take something good and you just kill it. So that's what I'm afraid they may do. But we'll see. I'm not even sure. I mean, what other legends are they going to get? We always see the same faces on TV. I mean, we get the Ultimate Warrior or somebody to come on Raw. What's he going to do? I say, one of these ideas that I had going back many years, and I would tell this to my brother and he would kind of laugh at me, but I think there's something here. I always said that a cool segment for Raw, which wouldn't just be, you know, prostituting the legends for the sake of prostituting the legends. You take an old face and you put him on the show and you put him in a role that it fits into the show. So you don't have a guy go out there and just have a match, unless he's going to put over some younger guys, which I guess you can do. But you put him out there for a talk segment. And, you know, King Kong Bundy is somebody that we have not seen on WWE television in many years. And I always thought the guy was actually a hell of a talker. I mean, if you go back and watch some of those early promos when he was feuding with Hogan, you know, and he would talk about how Bundamania was running wild and everything, he was actually a very good promo guy, I thought, compared to some of the other big guys back then who could barely speak. And Bundy, for those of you who don't know, has gone into stand-up comedy. He has done stand-up comedy quite a bit over the last several years, in fact. Now, I have yet to hear his act, so I don't know how funny or not it is. I would love to go to a show. I don't know how often he performs or anything like that. I know Mick Foley is doing stand-up comedy, too, but I always thought it would be cool to have King Kong Bundy on Raw with his own talk show segment. Call it the Five Count or something. You know, those of you who are familiar with Bundy's career know what I'm talking about when I mention the Five Count. And, you know, he can come out. I'm not saying he comes out and does, like, a comedy monologue, although that would be entertaining. But, you know, you take a guy like that and have him interview, you know, like the old Heartbreak Hotel or highlight reel with Jericho or Carlito's Cabana or something like that. You know, I don't know. It's just, I think if you're going to have a legend on the show every week, you should think along those lines. Think of having some sort of segment like that where they can actually play a role in the show. They can interview the young guys that are actually in angles and that are in storylines and help further those storylines. And, you know, at least it'll serve a purpose instead of just putting them in some bullshit comedy segment that is just a waste of time. So, anyway. Up next on this show, speaking of legends, we had Sean Mooney interviewing Daniel Bryan. Really, it was just one question. It took barely 10 seconds to spit out, but they should sign this man to a new deal and let him replace Josh Matthews. Or better yet, bring back those old event center updates during the shows that they can, you know, back in the day, they would help run down the pay-per-view cards and help get those shows over. Just bring that back and just let Mooney do them. Elsewhere, we had some comedy with Zack Ryder, John Cena, and Mean Gene Okerlund. Zack accused Mean Gene of being the brains behind the old GTV gimmick that was quickly dropped. Okerlund astutely pointed out that he wasn't even working for WWE at the time. He was with WCW, in fact. So how could it possibly be him? And Rock walked up, so Ryder and Gene bailed, leaving Cena and Rock together. Rock said that it had been a long time since they last saw each other. Yep, it's been an entire 3.5 months. I mean, shit, that's like a lifetime, I guess, in WWE. Anyway, Cena said he would be the champion come Royal Rumble. It would be him facing The Rock, and The Rock said he looks forward to it. Oh, God, I hope this doesn't mean that Cena's winning the Rumble next year. Kane came to the ring in the next segment. He was interrupted by the Jobber Brigade of Jinder Mahal, Curt Hawkins, Tyler Rex, Junico Camacho, and Drew McIntyre. They were all about to gang up on the Big Red Machine when we heard a gong, and the lights went dark, and out came The Undertaker for the first time since WrestleMania. And people went nuts for him. He went to take his hood off, and somehow it got stuck on his bald head, so that was kind of funny. He is still sporting a mohawk, by the way. And my God, did he look old. I mean, maybe I just didn't notice it as much because, you know, at WrestleMania, I was there in Miami live. I didn't watch it on TV. But he just looked ancient here. and he wasn't moving very well either. And I saw a note in this week's Wrestling Observer newsletter where apparently, Undertaker needed help from the officials just to get his jacket off. They apparently had to... I mean, they were filming all the, Mahal and Hawkins and Rex on the outside, and while they were filming that, people rushed into the ring and helped him take his jacket off. I just find that really depressing. I mean, how fucked must his arms and shoulders be if he can't even take his own jacket off? So anyway, it was still cool to see him and Kane clean house on everyone. They delivered stereo choke slams and stereo tombstone pile drivers. The crowd chanted, "This is awesome." Taker knelt down and posed, and Kane stood behind him. Just a really cool moment. You know, the only thing missing here was Paul Bear, who's probably still sitting in a meat locker somewhere after Randy Orton kidnapped him and Kane left him in there to freeze. So that would have made this perfect, I think. Main event was John Cena cashing in his Money in the Bank briefcase against CM Punk for the WWE Championship. They had a match. Punk went to give Cena the go to sleep, but Cena shoved him into the referee, who took a bump. Cena nailed the attitude adjustment and got the visual pin on Punk while the referee was down. And I know it's minor. This is definitely a nitpick, but things like this really annoy me. If you remember their epic match from last year at Money in the Bank, Punk took something like 3 AAs during the course of that match and kicked out of each one. And mind you, you know, we're talking a 20, 30, 35 minute match there. You know, he was over half an hour into a grueling match and he's kicking out of all these finishers. And here, you know, they've barely been wrestling for 10 minutes and he takes one AA and he can't kick out. I mean, you can argue that, you know, he knew the ref was knocked out, so why expend your energy kicking out? But I don't know. It just bugged me. Big Show ran out. He speared Cena at this point, gave him the WMD knockout punch, which left Punk with a bit of a dilemma. He saw what happened. Do you capitalize on it, or do you give your opponent a chance to recover? And of course, if that's me, I cover him right away. If that makes me a bad guy, then so be it. But Punk is conflicted. He's not sure what to do, and he throws the referee back into the ring and decides to cover Cena, but he only gets two. Punk tries for the GTS again. Cena reverses it into an STF, which brings Big Show back in to break up the submission attempt. So Cena wins on a disqualification. Just a horrible finish for a Money in the Bank cash-in. If it wasn't for the Money in the Bank, I wouldn't mind the DQ so much because I would not have expected a clean finish here. But just for a Money in the Bank cash-in, just a terrible way for that match to end. Big Show beats up Cena some more. Punk doesn't even try to help him. He just goes to leave. Rock's music hits, he runs to the ring, he beats up Big Show, he gives him a spine buster. You have never seen a man more fired up than Rock was at this point. And he goes to deliver the people's elbow, and this was shades of when Shane McMahon once screwed the Rock. Ironically, it was in a match against the Big Show. And he bashed the Rock in the head with a steel chair as he came off the ropes for the elbow. Well, I guess since chair shots to the head are banned, here we had Punk scurrying back into the ring and stopping Rock dead in his tracks with a clothesline. And people started booing. Some people were cheering, but most people were booing. Punk just gazed into the crowd. He had this kind of blank stare that Shawn Michaels had the night that he turned heel and super kicked Hulk Hogan's head off his shoulders. And Punk then hoisted Rock up. He gave him the GTS to add insult to injury, and he walked out with the WWE title belt. And by the way, I wonder if we get that rumored new championship belt this Monday on the show. We didn't get it on Raw this past week like I thought we might. I'd have Punk come out and just, you know, mention how a year ago he talked about changing the title, but, you know, he just became another cog in the machine, he got soft, and now it's time for some real change, and then he unveils the new title. You know, there won't be a better time for him to do it than this Monday, in my opinion. If they have a new belt made, which, you know, we had pictures floating around the internet, supposedly of one of the plates on the new belt. If there's a new belt somewhere, I don't know what they're waiting for. I would think this Monday would be the time to do it when Punk comes out to do his promo. And that was Raw 1000. A fun show overall, even if it was way overhyped and did drag a lot in the middle. It wasn't the monumental show they made it out to be by any means. You know, jobbing out Jack Swagger in a 10-second match is fine on a show as packed as this one, and one that was really all about nostalgia, but you can't pull that shit on Raw 1001 or 1002. Not with 3 hours to fill every week. You know, to me, the real test begins this Monday. CM Punk, he can drop the mother of all pipe bombs. You can bring Randy Orton back. He, as of today, by the way, he is eligible to come back from his suspension. so you can bring Orton back. You can do something to further the Triple H Lesnar storyline. Lesnar should be on TV pretty much every week now. All these different things that you can do on this next show, but you're still going to have another 2 hours, let's say, on that show to build around all of those key angles. So it's time to put up or shut up here. You've got some momentum coming out of this show. Don't squander it. Switching over to TNA now. Impact Wrestling this past Thursday night. First of all, despite claims from the TNA side that that Impact Rewind show was going to be back on the air, it was only off the air for 1 week. You know, it's like that cop from South Park. You know, nothing to see here, people. Nothing to see. Well, despite all that, it was complete bullshit. The show appears to be dead. It did not air before Impact this week again. The big angle on this week's show was Bobby Roode accusing James Storm of being the mastermind behind Aces and Eights, since he has yet to be attacked by them. They attacked some more people this week, by the way, but at the end of the show, all the babyfaces ganged up on Aces and Eights, and they fled without laying a finger on Storm, interestingly enough, which caused everyone to question his loyalty. What I thought was really interesting about this is, you know, that while this was all going on, you know, you had Angle and others getting up in Storm's face, again, questioning whether or not he was with them or against them. There in the background, in the corner, standing there, is Sting, who has been reappointed, by the way, as the GM of Impact Wrestling in Hulk Hogan's absence. Why is that interesting, you might say? Well, this is almost the exact same angle they did with Sting in WCW when the NWO first came in. If you'll recall, they had the fake Sting and all the baby faces, including his own friend Lex Luger, were questioning Sting's loyalty to the company, which resulted in Sting going all emo and sitting up in the rafters and painting his face black and white. So here we have James Storm playing the role of Sting from 16 years ago as Sting himself stands there looking on. I just thought it was kind of interesting. I'm not sure how many other people picked up on that, but if next week we have James Storm drinking a beer by himself on the roof of the Impact Zone, then you'll know why. There were some good matches on the show. Kurt Angle and Bully Ray had a very good main event, with Angle pinning Ray to earn 7 points in the Bound for Glory series. By the way, I did see Kurt Angle's video on Funny or Die, Olympic Trials. I thought it was very funny. It made me long for the days of comedy Kurt. Kurt Angle's gone through these different phases in his career. You know, when he first started out, he went heel. He was a comedy figure. Great wrestler, of course, but for the most part, he was doing comedy, and he was great. He was great. He was hilarious. And then, you know, he got more serious, but then he would do comedy, and then he would get more serious, and then when he joined the ECW brand and he started wearing the mouth guard, he was all serious. He was all business all the time, no comedy, no funny business. And then he left the company, he went to TNA, and ever since he's been in TNA, he's pretty much played the same role. I mean, you know, there may be some jokes here and there, but for the most part, he's that respected, grizzled veteran, the serious guy, the machine who goes in there and has great matches, and that's fine. But to me, especially as he gets a little bit older and maybe he slows down a little bit more, I would like to see a return to comedy for Kurt Angle, because the guy is so goddamn good at it. So if you haven't seen the Funny or Die video, check it out. It's pretty funny. The other Bound for Glory series match on this show was James Storm and AJ Styles. They wrestled to a no contest after Aces and Eights ran in. They attacked AJ, but not Storm. Yet we were told that both men were being each awarded 2 points in the Bound for Glory series. How that makes any sense, I don't know. They showed Claire Lynch sitting in the crowd during this match, making hilariously awful mean girl faces at AJ Styles. Really, it looked like someone took a dump under her seat and she just couldn't tell where the stench was coming from. I find this woman insanely entertaining in the worst possible way. That's the only way I can describe it. We also had the much ballyhooed debut of Chavo Guerrero Jr. on this show. They made a much bigger deal about this than they should have. They were airing comments from Tara and Kid Cash and Hernandez and Kurt Angle, all touting Chavo's arrival. And I love how Kurt Angle started by saying, "I've had some amazing matches with the late, great Eddie Guerrero. And, oh yeah, I've also wrestled Chavo, too." It's like, he didn't actually say it that way, but that's kind of how I interpreted it. If they did this with an actual star coming in, it might mean more. And I don't fault TNA for any of it. I mean, they're certainly doing everything they can to make him out to be a big deal, but he just isn't. I mean, Chavo never did anything for me in WWE. He'll do less for me in TNA. You know, he cut a promo that really wasn't very good. At one point in the promo, he said something to the effect of, like, he wasn't saying that he's a wrestling legend. These people are saying it, referring to the crowd. And no, they're not. to them, you're the guy who feuded with Hornswoggle. So Kid Cash and Gunner came out. And where the fuck has Gunner been on TV, by the way? He's been missing in action for a while. So anyway, they came out. They made fun of Chavo. I thought they were going to make a joke about Eddie not being here anymore. Thankfully, they did not. This ended with a brawl, and Hernandez came out to the ring to even out the odds and help Chavo. It's funny watching Hernandez run to the ring. It looks like he's got a stick up his ass. It was very bizarre watching him run to the ring. I just thought that was funny. So, yeah, that was the stuff with Chavo. You know, whatever. I Chavo has never been a favorite of mine. They had Gut Check this week with Sam Shaw, who was back after his beatdown last week at the hands of Aces and Eights. He had a match with Douglas Williams. It went 3 minutes. He looked fine. Later on, the judges voted to give him a TNA contract. I will give him this. Sam Shaw celebrated like it was his dream come true when he found out that he got a contract. You know, I thought that was really cool. You really felt happy for the guy. He was jumping up and down. He was screaming. He was hugging each judge. He hugged him twice. See, you know, you feel really good for the guy. Here's the problem I have with this. The problem I have is that I think they've given contracts to everybody except Joey Ryan so far. And Ryan is obviously in, because they're still doing an angle with him showing up unannounced at all these events. You know, this week he showed up in the crowd and he slapped that. Actually, he didn't slap Al Snow in the face. He punched him in the face. I went back. Somebody did an animated GIF of the punch. He sucker punched Al Snow right in the jaw. I mean, he nailed him good right in the face. So, you know, obviously Joey Ryan is in. They're going to do something with him. I've had people write into me, you know, figuring maybe he's the one behind Aces and Eights, which I don't think he is. It would make sense if he was. But Joey Ryan, I don't know, his character behind him being behind Aces and Eights, I don't know. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me. It just doesn't fit his character, I don't think. But the point here is that if you're just going to give out contracts to everybody, what's the point of Gut Check? I mean, if Sam Shaw showed amazing charisma or something like that, then fine, but he didn't come across as anything special. For a company with money issues, you know, they're trying to keep the purse strings tight, boy, they sure are giving out contracts like candy to these guys. You know, they're already bringing in X-Division guys like Kenny King and Rashad Cameron, and they brought back Sanjay Dutt, guys with experience who are actually polished and deserve a shot. I mean, you would think that would be enough, and you wouldn't have to give contracts to these unknowns. I mean, if you want to sign some of these people and send them to OVW, who, you know, TNA has a relationship with, I have no problem with that. You know, they should have some sort of developmental system of their own. But, you know, to do these Gut Check segments and just give contracts to everybody so far, and even the one person you didn't give a contract to is clearly in the company. I don't know, it just defeats the whole purpose, and it takes away some of the drama of doing these Gut Check segments. You can't give everybody a contract. You just, at some point, you've just got to say no and just cut bait. So I don't know. Hopefully, next time we'll see what happens. Although, you know, again, next time if they have somebody on Gut Check who deserves a contract, I hope they give them a contract. But I just think it's a little ridiculous. Speaking of Kenny King, he was chosen by Austin Aries to wrestle Zema Ion for the X Division title. Sting had put Aries in charge of making the decision. Bruce Pritchard accidentally walked in on the live shot with Aries before this match, so that'll make a Botchamania video at some point. Ion and King had a good match. It ended with Bobby Roode costing King the victory. He said he was sending a message to Austin Aries that he could take away any opportunity that he gives someone. And this brought out Aries. A brawl ensued. They announced that next week it'll be Bobby Roode and Zema Ion against Austin Aries and Kenny King. So that's nice to see them giving the X Division guys some rub. Plus, that should be a pretty freaking good match. No Joseph Park on this show. Very disappointing. Personally, I think Joe Park would have made a fine choice as the interim GM of Impact Wrestling, even though I don't think you need a GM at all. His story with Bully Ray is, you know, pretty much played itself out at this point. So where does the character really go from here? You know, why not make him an authority figure? He already wears a suit. He is an attorney, after all. It actually makes a lot of sense to put him in that kind of role. It's a way to get him on TV. I mean, I had heard they filmed some fake law firm commercials with Joe Park a couple weeks ago. And unless I missed them, I don't think they've aired yet. I must see these. But, yes, unfortunately, he was not the GM, and he was not on this show at all. So, that's not good. But it was a good show overall, better than last week. But they've all been good to very good, going on about 2 months now. So what TNA is now doing is they're establishing a pattern, a consistent pattern of good television, which I think long-term is what you have to do. Is it going to move ratings? You know, for their sake, I hope it does at some point. The fact that the ratings really, they did rebound this week. They because of the DirecTV stuff, probably they had been down. So they did rebound, but it wasn't like they've been doing amazing numbers or anything like that. Spike TV is considering, by the way, in spite of the average ratings that the show has been getting, Spike is still considering keeping Impact live every week. Once the summer run is over, they may possibly keep the show live. I got my fingers crossed for them. I hope they keep it live. I really think it does improve the show a lot. I'm not even talking about spoilers and all that stuff. It makes the show feel different than knowing that you've got 2 or 3 weeks worth of television in the can. So, and I think it helps the crowd too. I feel like the crowd on some level is into it more because they know they're live on TV. So, I'm hoping Spike will keep it live, but we don't know yet. But as I said, they're establishing a pattern of good television, which is something WWE is seemingly unable to do. You know, WWE can put on an amazing Raw show, and then for the next 3 weeks, spoon-feed us complete horseshit. And what TNA is doing is they're giving us a consistently good to very good television show. It's actually, it's quite, you know, it's been something of a pleasure to be able to watch. And, you know, the thing about it is it's a solid, sometimes better alternative to WWE, which is really all that any wrestling fan could ask for. It's that alternative. It's having that option. It's having something other than CM Punk and John Cena and Sheamus and the usual, you know, BS that you get on Raw and SmackDown. It's nice to have an alternative that isn't embarrassing to watch. And like I said, this was a good show. According to reports that originated earlier in the week on PWInsider.com, TNA sources say the contracts for Bully Ray and D-Von, the reigning TV champion, are set to expire in the next couple of weeks, probably in the next 3 or 4 weeks, in fact. And the pair apparently have been negotiating new deals with the company, but no real progress has been made. It's disconcerting to me just because, you know, Bully Ray is probably the best heel in all of wrestling right now. And he's also in the best shape of his life. He's been reborn as a singles performer, and he also doubles as an agent behind the scenes for TNA. So he wears more than one hat in that company. He's not just an on-air performer. I think losing him would be a big blow to the company. I've said before that he's one of the best things about that product, and I wish he would stay there only because I don't trust WWE enough to let him be himself the way that TNA gives him the latitude to be himself on TV. But obviously, if he can't reach a deal with TNA, I would hope to see him back on TV somewhere else. And let's face it, there's really only one other place to go. As far as D-Von is concerned, you know, from what I understand, D-Von is very good with working with some of the younger guys and mentoring, you know, Garrett Bischoff and stuff like that. But you know what? D-Von is the TV champion, and supposedly he was going to be defending his title every week, and I can't remember the last time he defended his title on TV. I can't remember the last time he had a match on TV. It was probably a tag match a couple weeks ago with Garrett Bischoff. So if they're not really doing much with him, I would be less heartbroken if D-Von left, to be honest. I probably wouldn't even notice. But Bully Ray, I would definitely notice. And in addition to those guys, Velvet Sky is officially done with TNA. She is kaput. She posted the following on Twitter on Thursday. She said, "I have been granted my release by TNA at this time. It's what's best for me right now. And I wanted to thank TNA and all the fans for their constant support of me. I also want to thank Vince Russo for creating and believing in the team of the beautiful people. We had a great run." And she is already booked for a convention in New Jersey the same weekend as Bound for Glory. So that pretty much was a sign that she was gone right there. She had been with the company since 2007 and was part of the Beautiful People with Angelina Love, who also departed from TNA several months back. And, you know, the thing about Velvet, even though she is a terrible wrestler, she's still one of the most popular performers in the company. She's very attractive. She's got a great act, you know, and she's got tremendous assets, shall we say. You know, she wouldn't really add much to the Divas division in WWE in terms of being a wrestler. She wouldn't go in there and have great matches with anybody. But since WWE doesn't really make that a priority, she'd be a big pickup for them. I think she could be a big star there. She's got the look. Like I said, very attractive. As a performer, I think she's great. As a wrestler, not so much. But I still think she could become a big deal in WWE if they wanted to sign her, which I don't know if there's any interest there or not, or what her non-compete clause might be with TNA. But she is gone from the company. The problem with WWE potentially recruiting any of the three, whether it's D-Von, Bully Ray, or Velvet Sky, lies with this ongoing lawsuit that TNA filed against them that stemmed from the whole tampering debacle and Ric Flair leaving the company. You know, Jerry McDevitt, the attorney for WWE, made it very clear to the court that WWE was not interested in signing any talents from TNA, including Ric Flair. Now, I don't buy that for a second, that they don't want to bring any of their stars over. I'm sure they would love to. And from what I understand, they wanted Flair back for the Raw 1000 show last week, and the fact that he was not on that show was quite telling. They've kind of painted themselves, WWE has, into a bit of a corner with McDevitt's comments. You know, if they sign any of these guys, it makes him look like a liar, and it hurts their case. You know, all TNA has to do is go to the court and say, listen, they're talking out of both sides of their mouth here. So just because Bully Ray or Velvet Sky or even Ric Flair may be gone from TNA does not necessarily mean that WWE is going to come in and swoop them right up. You know, there may be a hiring freeze on TNA talent for a while until the legal stuff gets resolved. And if that's the case, that takes away whatever bargaining leverage these folks may have if they're trying to negotiate a better deal with TNA. So it's going to be very interesting to follow this situation as it unfolds. Apparently there's a lot of unrest behind the scenes in TNA, and Bruce Pritchard is being made to be the bad guy here. And as Jim Ross probably was back in the day when he was the head of talent relations, and Jerry, John Laurinaitis after him, they kind of get a bad rap because when the company wants to make cuts or restructure deals in this case, apparently the situation is that they want to sign, you know, people like Bully Ray, let's say, who may have a normal contract, he gets a salary or whatever. They want to pay these people now on a per-appearance basis, which is a very different type of arrangement. And that seems to be what Bully and some other people are resisting. And Bruce Pritchard and people like that tend to get a bad rap because, you know, their orders come from the top. If TNA is saying, listen, we got to cut costs, we want to restructure these deals, you're the head of talent relations, you got to deal with these guys, you got to go with them and talk to them about this. I almost feel sorry for him being put in that type of position. So, like I said, going to be very interesting to follow the situation, see who stays and who goes, and if they do go, how long it is before they show up in WWE, if they show up there at all. I mean, really, if they don't, where are they going to go? Is somebody like a Bully Ray going to go to Ring of Honor? You know, is he going to go work for his buddy Tommy Dreamer's new independent promotion here in New York? I don't know. Time for shout-outs and mailbag questions. They're kind of merged this week. A lot of people who sent in shout-outs included questions as well, and there's quite a bit of them, so we're just going to tackle all of this at once. If you have shout-outs or questions for me, you must email me directly at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the email address for any and all feedback. And first things first here, he didn't request this, but I want to give a shout-out anyway to James Alexander, ring announcer extraordinaire. He is an avid fan of the Sound Off as well for quite some time. He will be celebrating a birthday tomorrow, July 30th, so happy birthday, buddy. I promise I will watch your DVD soon. I just have not had a chance to do so. First shout-out here comes from Marcus Reigns, listener since episode 145 and a member of the Triple Threat. He wanted to get a birthday shout-out. He is turning 24 on July 27th. Well, I guess he already did turn 24. It's a birthday that he shared with both Triple H and Dolph Ziggler. That's right, Triple H turned 43 this week. He's getting up there, is Triple H. Anyway, Marcus's question is, what are your favorite signature bumps? From the way that Shawn Michaels flips in the corner to Triple H being slingshot into everything, the flare flop, Foley's flip over the steel steps, there have been many, and I wanted to hear your top three. The Shawn Michaels flip is always fun to watch. The Million Dollar Man used to take this wacky bump over the top rope and out to the floor in almost every match that I always liked. If you've seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. So I guess that would be one. Let's see. Besides that, whenever Ravishing Rick Rude would take an inverted suplex, he would just stand there, kind of hunched over, squatting like his balls had just been put in a vise. That was always amusing. My favorite one probably is the corner bump that Bret Hart would take in almost every single one of his matches, where his opponent would just whip him chest first into the corner at like warp speed. And it just looked like the poor guy's chest was just absolutely caved in every single time. It looked like it moved the ring a couple of inches. I always liked that. Bret was always so damn good at selling a realistic beating during his matches. Probably never better than the King of the Ring in 93, which is still one of my all-time favorite pay-per-views. So, yeah, those would probably be three of the ones I would pick. Mark Ventris has been listening, or Ventris, hopefully I pronounced that right, has been listening since September of 2010. He says, my birthday is on July 30th. Can I please get a shout-out? Well, you certainly can. Happy birthday. Also, he says, I was wondering what your thoughts are on the story of Alex Riley not taking a rib from John Cena the correct way and him not getting pushed as a result. I saw that report. It's all rumor, of course, but I could believe it. Again, I believe the Ken Doan stuff as well. When Ken Doan came out and shared the stories of what happened, how his push got derailed, and why he got fired from WWE and the heat that John Cena has with him, I believe him. And I could believe this as well. You know, Cena comes... He comes across like a nice enough guy. You know, he was to us, you know, myself and Noah and Brian when we interviewed him at WrestleMania in Miami, although that was, you know, five or 10 minutes. But, you know, he does all the Make-A-Wish stuff. He's a hard worker. But he strikes me as the kind of person where if you do something to cross him or embarrass him, you end up on the shit list. And, you know, he was allegedly one of the main eventers that openly complained to management about Ken Anderson when he worked there. And, of course, Kennedy, now Anderson, was ultimately fired because of it. Listen, the Alex Riley thing, the story, it's as good an explanation as any for why Riley just kind of vanished from TV. You know, he's got the look that you would think they would like. He can talk really, really well. I mean, he talks like a main eventer. I have no other explanation for it. So he must have done something to piss somebody off, and that sounds like as good of a story as any. Jake from Long Island, New York, just wanted to know if I could get a birthday shout-out. My birthday was on July 27th, as it was for Ziggler and Triple H. I'm a huge fan of the show. It always makes my Sundays great. So happy birthday, Jake. Michael Kulitu writes in, I wanted to ask if I could possibly get a shout-out on the show. Just this morning, I found out that I got accepted to a business university, and I am overjoyed. Also, I left you a review in iTunes with a 5-star rating for the greatest wrestling podcast of all time. Well, thank you, Michael. And congratulations on being accepted to a business university. If only some of the people in TNA could have graduated from a business university, perhaps their actual business would be doing a little bit better. I think we need more business majors to go into wrestling, I think, is the problem. I don't think certain people get the concept of how business works. And that's a problem sometimes. Jesse Wagstaff from Swansboro, North Carolina, writes in, can I get a shout-out on the show? I've been listening to the podcast since 2010. I love wrestling, especially WWE. My favorite wrestlers are John Cena and Austin Aries. You persuaded me to watch Impact Wrestling, and I thank you for that. I also have a question. Do you think Sting would ever come to WWE? At this point, I think the only way we see him there is when he gets inducted into the Hall of Fame once his TNA days are over. Unless WWE is going to be really petty, you know, being the TNA is going to be the first to put Sting into a Hall of Fame. And then they decide, well, we don't want to do it. Eventually, I see him going in. But as far as coming in for a WrestleMania match or a run, you know what? The closest that they have ever come was with the whole Undertaker stuff. Was it this year or the year before? It was the year before last. And last year would have been. Because Sting himself had said that he hadn't decided yet if he was coming back. His TNA deal had expired. And he actually had spoken with somebody in WWE. When all the people on the internet made such a big deal about, oh my God, it's going to be Sting and The Undertaker, and remember those videos that were airing on WWE TV that people thought might be for Sting, and he considered it and ultimately decided against it, and that was about as close, I think, as he's ever come to coming in, and I think that was it right there. I think that was the time to do it. It didn't happen. Like I said before, Sting is revered in TNA. He's treated like an icon, like his nickname. You know, he's a legend. They're putting him into the Hall of Fame, and I really do think, as cool as it would be to see Sting in WWE, he should stay in TNA. I would actually be very sad for them if he decided to bail and go to WWE for a match or an angle or something, because you know the dude's 54 years old. He's not getting any younger. The people in TNA obviously love him. They've treated him very, very well. it's at a point now where, you know, Sting, who I believe made a few appearances for TNA in the early days before 2006, but I think it was in 2006 that he officially debuted, and he's pretty much been there ever since. That's a long time. You know, that's 6+ years now that he has been with TNA. And in a lot of ways, it may not be as long as he was with, you know, the NWA / WCW before the company folded. He was there a lot longer, but Sting was looked at as the, quote, franchise player in WCW. And in a lot of ways now, with all the time that's gone by, he has become the franchise player in TNA. And I think it would be almost wrong of him to leave and sign some sort of deal with the WWE. Except for the Hall of Fame. I think that would be fine. But they wouldn't do that until he officially cut ties with TNA, and he seems happy enough there. I don't see him doing that anytime soon. Jamel from Brooklyn, New York. I've listened to the Sound Off since episode 80. Today, Sunday, is my birthday. Can I get a shout-out? Absolutely. Jamel, can give you a shout-out, especially somebody from Brooklyn. I don't think I would turn down a shout-out from somebody from there. My question is, I was watching the Vince McMahon DVD, and I noticed two things. One, that in the Brian Pillman gun scene, it was the same house they used for the Triple H Randy Orton angle, as well as others. Wouldn't it be more realistic to actually do it in different locations? What are your thoughts? Keep up the good work. I hope we can all be listening to Sound Off 1000, and I hope to meet you at WrestleMania 29 in our hometown. Well, WrestleMania 29 is in the next state over, but I guess New York, New Jersey, it's all the same. But thank you for that, and I think you're wrong on the house. I'm pretty sure that house that they used in the Triple H Randy Orton angle was, in fact, not the same house they used in the Brian Pillman angle. To the best of my knowledge, the house in the Pillman angle was really Pillman's home. But even if it wasn't, that house was totally different, even the exterior, let alone the interior. So maybe to you they look similar, but I'm 99.9% sure that it was not the same house. Justin Bridge writes in, I've been listening to you since episode 140. Can I get a shout-out on your podcast? Absolutely, Justin. I'm joining the Army, he says, and this Monday I'm going to MEPS. I'm not sure what that is. Maybe somebody else can help me out here. He is going to MEPS to make sure I am healthy enough to join and to take the test to find out what jobs I might be able to get. So good luck with that, Justin. This last one here comes from Jeremy Winters from Warner Robins, Georgia. My wife and I follow you on Facebook. I've been listening since around the early 70s episodes, just shortly before your infamous Michael Jackson rant, and my wife since shortly after that. Favorite episodes of mine are 75, 127, 212, and 228, with your throwback moments from Monday Night Raw. I'm emailing you to request a birthday shout-out for my wife, Mary, who turns 29 today. Unfortunately, she is currently sick with bronchitis and has passed it on to me, so we make a great pair. Also, I wanted to ask, out of all of your episodes, which one has been the most fun making, and the one that you look back on the fondest, whether it be an interview segment, something you took while assembling the show? We listen each week religiously. I carry a number of sound-offs with me on my BlackBerry at work to get some good laughs on those stressful days. We appreciate you doing what you do. You truly enjoy doing them, it seems, and it comes through to all of us listening. So that comes from Jeremy, and that was really cool. I thank him for that. And happy birthday to Mary, by the way. Hope you guys feel better very soon. As far as which show I enjoyed making the most, probably 212. You know, the show we did from Miami was myself, Noah Mark, and Brian Blade, WrestleMania weekend a couple months ago. I mean, we were exhausted when we did that show. I don't even know how we did that show. I don't even know how Noah managed to stay up long enough to help edit the show. I give him a lot of credit for that. But we were all completely wiped out. We did that show. We started recording probably around midnight or something, and we had already been up for a ridiculous amount of time. That aspect of it actually wasn't fun, because especially once it was over, people don't realize sometimes that once the show is over, like, you know, I have a way here, a system of recording and doing things here, and you know, I've got it down like a science, but even that takes time. So once the actual recording is done, I have to go back and insert the outro or the intro. It has to be saved and converted, which, you know, some of these shows, as long as they are, I mean, I could sit here, you know, with this thing converting for minutes and minutes on end. And then I have to convert it to a different format. It has to be uploaded, and Podbean sometimes makes me like the Incredible Hulk, you know, Hulk smash. So it's a process, but in Miami it was a lot different because we had actual audio equipment. We had a pipe and two other people in addition to myself. It wasn't an easy process, and yet I had a blast recording that show. It was a lot of fun. That whole day was a lot of fun. We got to interview a whole bunch of people, and I think that was part of it, too, having to splice in all the different interview clips from our interviews with Daniel Bryan and Kofi Kingston and Edge and Shawn Michaels and John Cena. Yeah, the Horsemen as well. We interviewed a fuck ton of people in Miami, by the way. So if you've never listened to episode 212, get your ass online and make sure you download and listen to that show. The interviews are at the end. It was a lot of fun to listen back to, a lot of fun to record. So I'd probably have to say 212. A lot of the other shows, they just kind of blend together. There have been some shows that I couldn't wait to hook in the microphone and just lace into WWE or TNA for one reason. I remember for whatever reason, particularly being angry with TNA when I recorded. I think it was episode 156. But they all kind of blend together to me. So 212 was a lot of fun. Hopefully, at some point in the future, we'll be able to do more of those. If you have shout-outs that you would like to request for the show, I try to get to as many of them as I can, or questions, please send in your questions to thesolemonster@gmail.com, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Follow me on Twitter, @solemonster, as well. We always have a good time on there. And friend me on Facebook, facebook.com/thesolemonster. We had something like almost 700 comments in our Raw 1000 thread this past Monday night. A lot of debate, a lot of activity. A lot of differing opinions on the show this past Monday night. There were a lot of people who hated that show. Like I said, it wasn't a feeling for me of hatred so much as it was a bit of disappointment, I guess, or that underwhelming feeling when the show first went off the air. And then I thought about it a little more, and I went back and I watched some of the stuff, and I appreciated the show for what it was. It was not necessarily the way that I would have booked a Raw 1000 show with all the old faces. Maybe I would have, again, done things a little bit differently, or had some sort of roll call segment where I think they did that on the old school Raw back in 2010, where they kind of lined everybody up side by side under the Titantron and they introduced them and they called out their name, something like that. But you know what? There were a lot of cool things on the show with the DX stuff and Lesnar and Triple H and the Punk turn and Rock being there and little things like Slick and Sean Mooney. How can I hate on a show like that? Believe me, I have ranted a lot about Raw over the last several weeks and may well rant about them again on the next show if they come back with episode 1001 this week and it's, a turd, which hopefully it won't be. There'll be plenty of time for that, and I'm more concerned about the three-hour shows going forward. But for what this was, I can't hate. It was fine. I can nitpick little things, but what's the point? But certainly we have a lively debate in Facebook and the thread every single week, so you should get in on that. It's a lot of fun, a lot of good people on there. So hit me up on Facebook, and you can subscribe to The Sound Off in iTunes. It is free. Type in the name of the show. Please leave a review if you have a couple of minutes. And subscribe to my YouTube channel, youtube.com. It is my username is all one word, The Solemonster. And I may have something up there possibly later today. So you'll want to check that out as well. That's going to do it for episode 230. I want to thank you all for your support. Please continue to spread the good word of The Sound Off. A lot of people listening right now were recommended by existing listeners. That's how we get quite a few new listeners, in fact, so I appreciate that. And we'll be right back here next weekend with episode 231, which I may or may not do a day early. I have a party next Sunday night. I'll try to do the show normal time, but if anything, maybe it'll be a little bit earlier. I'll keep you guys updated on Twitter about that. So until next time, be well, stay safe, have a very good week, and enjoy Raw 1001 Impact and everything else, and we'll see you right back here next weekend.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solemonster sounds off on SEScoops.com.